Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that? We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote BatChat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes. Hello and welcome to Bat Chat, the podcast from the Bat Conservation Trust, where we're taking you out into the field to discover the world of bat conservation. Yes, hello, welcome back folks, you're listening to Bat Chat, which is for anyone with an interest in the secretive mammals filling our skies at night. I'm Steve Rowe. Professionally, I'm an ecologist, and in my spare time, as well as doing this podcast, I'm a trustee for the Bat Conservation Trust. This is the final episode of Series 5, but don't panic, we have some news on that for you later in the show. This week, I'm taking you to a Welsh woodland to meet Richard Crompton. Over the years, I've had countless people ask me how to go about getting a bat licence, and so I thought, who better to guide you through the process than someone who has trained nearly 400 people for their bat licence? So I don't think anybody could accuse me of not putting effort in to get these episodes. I was up at 4 this morning to get over to South Wales to meet our guest today, who is very well known in the bat world. And with Richard Crompton, which is a name familiar to lots of people in the bat world. Richard, do you want to just describe where we are, first of all, in terms of Wales?
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks for coming all this way, Steve. Yeah, we're actually just outside of Bridgend, just off the M4. You can possibly just hear the hum of vehicles in the distance, and this is a natural cave that we've just come to look at today. And we've just counted 48 lesser horseshoe bats in here, which is a little bit down on last year, but it's a cave that is subject to quite a lot of disturbance. So, but we promised you some horseshoe bats, so it had to be done.
Yeah, we're very well delivered, and we're in predominantly in an ash woodland, and it's quite steep. We're just sheltering in the entrance of the cave because it's just starting to drizzle a little bit. So, Richard, how did you get into bats, and how long have you been doing bat work?
My journey started, I was volunteering with the National Trust, Dunham Park up in Cheshire, just on the Cheshire-Manchester border. Actually, Duke of Edinburgh's award it was, but it was very much, career-wise, I wanted to be a kind of park warden. That was a countryside ranger, that sort of thing. That was what I was very much about. And age 15, I think it was, I went on a bat walk that was run by one of the local bat groups. And it was just kind of, wow, this is amazing, actually. And at that point, basically, as a volunteer warden, I went on a lot of the guided walks and things. And they were good. You know, they were all good. But for some reason, this one just was, wow. Okay, this is really special. Also, it confirmed what I'd always suspected, which is I could hear a lot of the bats. Certainly at that age, 15, 16 years of age, I could, you know, hear the noctules and not the pipistrelle feeding calls and social calls and things like that. But actually, these people were actually able to tell me what I was hearing, which was very exciting. And this clearly enthused me a lot. I was quite nerdy as a teenager and went off and built myself one of those kit magenta bat detectors. Yeah. I had to get the physics teacher at school to help me finish it off because I'd done something wrong. And so I went back the following year and they were kind of, oh, you know, this kid's keen sort of thing. So that was really nice. But I remember having a conversation with the park manager about it and saying, I think there was a different way of delivering this. I think it can be, we've got a very sort of cosmopolitan population close to here. You know, you've got Manchester, Liverpool, for a small park, small deer park, an awful lot of people, and so I think I suggested there was perhaps a different way of delivering it and we could reach out, promote it better. I think I just literally got this huge excitable bug about it, you know, and he said, okay, well, you can do it next year then. So he kind of gave me a year. So I think age 17, I gave my first guided bat walk. And that wasn't so much, I mean, you know, bat groups ebb and flow, don't they? And I think the group that was doing it at that point, I think they found it difficult. It was outside of their area and that sort of stuff. So I think they were quite happy to let somebody else do it. But they still came along and helped, which was really good. And it was both terrifying and amazing in equal measure. And so I did that for a few years. And we had, you know, we even had a couple of hundred people on one of them and relayed the talk with walkie-talkies and things like that. Silly, to be honest. Looking back, it was ridiculous. But what an amazing start. And then I went to Aberystwyth University and studied countryside management. And my lecturers sort of said, don't do bats. You've got a lot of knowledge about bats. Try and do something different. But I just knew that the only way I'd really manage my dissertation was to do it on bats. And I knew I'd actually get it done if I did that. So I spent a whole summer doing surveys, looking primarily at the weather and the impact on bat activity at that property, that National Trust property, and another one, Stile Country Park, very close to Manchester Airport. And in doing so, I think I did four nights a week and two dawns a week throughout the whole summer. And I'd recently been on a workshop in the Lake District with Tony Hudson. Tom McCowart took me. Tom McCowart gave me a lift there before I even really knew him. I rang up this guy called Tom, and he said, oh, I can pick you up and give you a lift, because I didn't have a car then. And there were some of the, I think, Dutch bat workers. I don't really remember, unfortunately. I wish I did, because I'd like to thank them, teaching us about backtracking.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is something we've almost grown out of these days. But we've basically spent this time running around the Lake District on this course, finding bat roosts, backtracking to bat roosts. And it was very athletic and very exhausting. But I employed the same technique and found a lot of roosts in trees, particularly at Dunham Park. And I think it was like 47, 48 roosts or something. And I didn't really understand that this might have been significant at the time. But when I wrote to Tony Mitchell-Jones at English Nature at the time, and he said, oh, well, we've only actually got 56 records of tree roosts in England at the moment. This is a massive, you know, this is really significant. So I suppose I got noticed without really meaning to. I mean, it was quite naive, really. But that's and then this, of course, enthuses you even more, sort of thing. Yeah. And what a lot of people don't know is that as I graduated 1997, I actually applied for a job with Bat Conservation Trust as a conservation officer, and turned it down for many and various reasons. It was the right thing for me at the time. I think having lived in rural West Wales for 3 years and utterly adored it, I mean, just totally loved every aspect of it, I think the juxtaposition of then going to London was going to be too much for me. I think that actually, looking back, was probably the main decider for me. So I turned them down. But I remember going to a Welsh Bat conference and David Woolley, who I think at the time was treasurer of BCT, who looks a bit like Captain Birdseye, and he's quite an austere character. I think he was Merchant Navy or something like that at some point in his career. But I didn't know him, and he was sat in the library of one of the Welsh Field Study Centres, Orrielton or somewhere like that. I don't remember exactly which one. And I remember going into this room to kind of check in for the conference, and it was just him in there, sat behind this massive leather top desk. And it suddenly felt like some curious kind of interview. And he said to me, oh, so you're Richard Crompton. And I thought, oh, what have I done? And he leant over the desk, stood up and leant over the desk and shook my hand, and he said, I think you've made a very sensible decision. He said, well done. He said, that can't have been easy. Yeah. And I thought, oh, phew, you know, what a nice man. And actually I enjoyed working with him on and off for many years. And I've seen him relatively recently as well. He's an old man now, but it was nice to see him, because these little moments, you know, really important along the way. So, and then I sort of stumbled into doing some, Tom McCowart finished off my license training at the time, which was great. But I'd had to travel a lot. I found at that time getting trained in the UK difficult. It seemed to be, I don't know if it was a closed shop or just that I wasn't I wasn't known to the right people, and living so far away, it's difficult to make connections with the right people. I mean, I still used to write to people, so this was before, you know, email was relatively new. Makes me sound ancient. So I'd actually chosen to go abroad, been to Slovakia, Mallorca, and done some trips just to try and particularly engage with some of the rarer species, because I didn't have any connections in southern England where most of the rare species were, and I felt it was really important to have this knowledge and awareness. And so, you know, like horseshoe bats, great, dealing with those, you know, that's comfortable, no problem. Finding out about the wider range of species and the stuff that you encounter occasionally, but just becoming more familiar, seemed really important. So it took me basically 10 years, I think, before I'd handled 10 species of bats. This, to me, was ludicrous, because I was also doing bat work commercially. Again, in that part of the world, there was a shortage. There weren't many people doing consultancy anyway. I mean, this is in the days when you used to go out with three different bat detectors, held on the clipboard with elastic bands tuned to different frequencies to do surveys. I literally remember one survey in 1998. That's what we did. It worked. You know, we got some good results from it, really. But it was a very different approach to what we do now. And I think, to cut a long story short, I was at a conference and chatting with Sandy Sowler about this, some years later, in fact, and we were just sort of saying, why are people still finding it so difficult to get trained, particularly as by this point there was a growing need for commercially trained and commercially practicing ecologists. And so she said, well, we better do something about it. And anybody who knows Sandy will know that she makes things happen.
Yeah.
And I think a week later we'd met up in I think Hay on Wye for lunch, and we basically designed bat license training course over a sort of extended lunch, about 3 hours, and we'd mulled over what we thought would work, and we'd both been training people, you know, for some time, and we'd got an idea what worked, but moving it into a sort of course format was fairly new territory. And I think there was certainly some resistance in some quarters about that, you know, perhaps rightly so, because it was a new approach. And I think the onus really was on us to prove that we could deliver good trainees because of it, you know. And I think actually that delivers us to a point, you know, now some 14 years later, where most people now train by portfolio. It's not so much a journey with a single trainer anymore. And that's not to say anything against any particular trainer, but just that by going out and working with and meeting other people, you can just get a much wider range of experience. And you pick up the bits you like and pick up the bits you don't, you know, you don't like, and make a decision about how you're going to operate. So I think it makes a lot more sense, really.
And you've done a lot of training, as you've just said there, for people over the years, and you're still doing it now. Why do you still put so much time and effort in, given that there's lots of other training courses now and it is easier to get into? Why do you still put that time and effort into people?
Partly I can't help it. I love it. I love enthusing about bats. But also, I don't want other people to find it as hard to train as I did.
Yeah.
And I don't think it needs to be. And also, I've got a bit of a campaign to try and help people unlearn some of the things some of the assumptions and beliefs that are out there as well. I'm quite keen that we try and get away from that, fixing some of the problems.
Yeah,
I suspect the majority of people who are going to be listening to this episode are going to be looking to get on the ladder, I suppose, to get their bat license. Can you just describe how the licensing process works? Because it can, especially now that we've changed into the class licensing system, it can be really confusing for people starting out, can't it?
It can. There's no doubt that if you look at the range of options, particularly in England, it does look a bit daunting. It's perhaps worth saying that England and Wales and Scotland have retained a more simple approach of licensing. And there's pros and cons to each way of looking at it, to be honest. The English class licensing system, for most people, would look at a class level 1 or class level 2 license. The main differences there being that a class level 1 doesn't permit handling and doesn't permit disturbing hibernating bats, and a level 2 does, and also introduces the use of an endoscope as well, which is obviously quite important. when this system was launched, I mean, the first thing is I think it was really good. I think the licensing system did need looking at. I remember Sandy and I wrote a letter because we already trained probably close to 100 people through bat license training course at that point. And we made some observations on what was coming, and there were some things that we agreed with and some that we didn't, and overall we congratulated Natural England for being bold enough to look and see if there was a better way of doing it, because I think there was definitely room for improvement. There are things that I would certainly like to see done differently. Would I revise it again? Well, I think probably, you know, in the light of things like earned recognition, which are coming along at the moment, I think that's going to be a new system by the looks of it. I can see some positives to that. I mean, again, there are some teething problems with that at the moment. All of these things are a process, and the problem is that the community is so diverse that everybody's needs are going to be so very different, you know. So, the essential requirements of the training are always going to be exactly the same. And in very simple terms, people just need to get out there and see bats. And if there's one thing I'd say, it's don't fall into the trap of just doing hundreds and hundreds of emergence and re-entry surveys. Because whilst you do learn something about bats, it's important to remember that the license itself is about licensable activities, and emergence and re-entry surveys aren't a licensable activity. So whenever you go to a roost, particularly if you're assisting doing an emergence or re-entry survey, ask if you can be taken inside. So actually make that visit count, even if that means turning up, you know, a couple of hours sooner or earlier in the day or whatever it happens to be, but make it count. Because it's only by getting up close and personal with bats that you'll really learn those skills. And you don't even need to have the person that's with you train you. The phrase I use is get them to think out loud. Yeah. So just talk about what they're doing. Just give you a sort of commentary. Oh, I'm looking here because this could happen. Or I'm checking behind here because that's the sort of place where we might find this species or that species, that sort of thing. And even little tips like how are they positioning the ladder and stuff like that. It's really important because it's all part of course, being safe, but also looking competent as well. And if you can breathe in confidently, get your ladders upstairs in somebody's house, comfortably set it up whilst also having a conversation, whilst easily opening the loft hatch, whatever mechanism it might be, and reasonably comfortably getting yourself up into a loft, that householder or that client is just going to be so much more comfortable instantly just because of your body language, because you clearly know what you're doing, you know. And it might sound silly because we haven't even started thinking about the bats yet, but it's all very much part of that process, and I think really important.
I mean, you touched on it there. I mean, I get people's bat logs and they say, can you have a look at this? And they've got dozens and dozens of transects. And you think, actually, let's filter out what you've actually got. And it's a lot less, isn't it? So just take us through the types of licensing and then the different levels, I guess, in the class system.
Okay, so the four levels, the four class levels, 1, 2, 3, and 4. So level 1 is, as I mentioned, without handling and without disturbing hibernating bats. Level 2 allows those things, the handling and hibernating bats, and the use of endoscopes as well. So that's really the target for most people. Personally, I encourage people to avoid getting a level 1 license. There are a lot of limitations to it. You can't really use it in winter. I don't like the idea of people being in a situation where they, you know, if you go into a roost in winter and you've only got a level 1 license and then you have to get out, well, you've caused disturbance at that point, probably. And also it's that that sort of competency thing as well. And there's actually, and this is one of the points I remember initially making to Natural England, is that it's harder to identify a bat tucked tightly into a crevice than it is a bat in the hand, assuming you can handle it comfortably. And actually, most people don't require that much training to be able to handle comfortably. So it sort of feels the wrong way around, because if you don't qualify for a level 2 license with handling, then how are you going to identify a bat when you can only see its hind foot, or just the forearm and a part of the ear or something like that? So it's slightly the wrong way around in that sense as well. So I always encourage people to focus on level 2. Don't sort of go for level 1 and then progress to level 2. Focus on level 2. Try and get all the skills towards level 2. And then if you need it, for example, to get a job or for something like that, maybe take the level 1 as it goes, but still keep going towards it. And then level 3 and level 4, many people would suggest feel like they're the wrong way around, because level 3 is actually adds... the ability to catch bats in a mist net, and level 4 enables people to catch bats in a harp trap. And the reason we'd suggest that might be feels like the wrong way around anyway, is because it's much easier to take a bat out of a harp trap, because you just scoop it out, than you do from a mist net, where you have to obviously untangle it from the fibres of the net, which takes quite a lot more training. I mean in the order of several hundred bats more. Not that you can't be competent if you've perhaps only done 50 or 100, but it's also that ability to know that what happens when you get one that's really tangled. Because suddenly, I mean, it happened to me on a course a couple of years ago. We ended up with 12 or 14 noctules in a net at a time, and that's because the first bat called in all the others, and suddenly you've got more bats than you would ever really want to deal with at that time. Very feisty, very vocal, very bitey bats, and so you need to be able to keep you cool, not be terrified of getting bitten, trust in the gloves, but get those bats out swiftly, and also be able to make the decision, right, we can close the top of this net so we don't catch any more before you even start. Yeah. That's that sort of thing. So there's a lot more decisions, because you potentially cause a lot more harm with a mist net. So it's not a technique that should be used lightly.
So the one question I always get asked is, how long is it going to take? And the answer is, how long is a piece of string? But in your experience, you've trained a lot of people. Yeah. On average, how long should people be expected to put time and effort in?
I probably get a couple of phone calls most weeks from people, and that's nearly always one of the questions that they ask. And I always suggest, assuming they've got, a background in ecology or environmental science, or some familiarity at least with the natural world, they should be looking at a couple of years minimum. And that's not to say it can't be done faster, and it perfectly well can be done faster. But I remember when I was trained, it was always very much making sure that you'd done the different activities throughout the different parts of the year. So I think it's very important to have seen the seasonal changes in activity. I think to do it in 1 year, you'd have to be very busy. You'd have to really dedicate your life to it. And for most people, I think that's probably unachievable or extremely, extremely challenging these days. But it does depend what your background is, and what you've done previously. And some people will quite often take 3 or 4 years, and it just depends how much you're willing to travel. My view is you need to have had experience with at least the range of species, because in England the standard survey, the class survey license, covers you for all of the 18 breeding species, so you shouldn't have a license if you've not got familiarity with horseshoe bats, for example. Now you could be forgiven for not having been up and close with Bechsteins or something like that, but at least you'll have the familiarity of most of the Myotis bats, and that sort of thing. Perhaps you won't have ever seen a grey long-eared bat up close, but at least you'll be very familiar with the brown long-eared bat, and you'll have read lots about grey long-eared bats. I remember my first grey long-eared bat. I just knew it was different.
Yeah,
I'd never seen one before. I could just tell it wasn't a brown long-eared bat. So, it's that sort of thing, really. It's having that diversity of experience, and And like I said before, also it's great to have worked with different people, whether they're trainers or not. I mean, I think the role of the trainer is diminishing in this world in a formal sense. I think it's really about just going and getting good experiences and really spending time thinking about what you're getting from that experience. And that should be reflected in the logbook as well. And that's something else that not everybody's told to do, is to make that logbook, whether digital or paper, it doesn't really matter these days, from the very start, and log everything. And I get trainees to put it to usually do it on Excel and do a tab for different activities and list things like maybe conferences and talks and emergent surveys and things like that, but then have a tab on handling and a tab on roost visits and a tab on hibernation visits and that sort of thing. So you can be absolutely explicit when you forward it to Natural England or whichever agency it is, and show them just how much you've done of actual, we call it bat contact time. And bat contact time we define as obviously seeing or handling bats or bat signs, basically. We try not to encourage too much emergent survey hours in that, because it's easy to rock up hundreds and hundreds of emergence survey hours without really gaining that much valuable extra knowledge about the species.
Yeah. And going back to the Greylongid, my first Greylongid, I looked at it in hand and thought, I know that's a Greylongid, even though I've never seen one before. Mm. So for that person who's listening to this episode, who's thinking, what is the first thing I should be doing to get a license? What would you say is it? Is it making contact with somebody, or is it the logbook or something else?
It's all about meeting the right people, to be honest. And if you can do that through the local bat groups, then that's brilliant, because that's the ideal place to start. When people want to come on a training course with me, the first thing we usually do is send them away to go and get more experience. So, go and get yourself, 100 hours or something like that in the bag before you even start to think about it. And write it down. And don't go looking for training, I think, is also a really important point. Go and get involved. Because training, in my experience, arrives organically. Once people see that you're just interested and want to be doing it. Now, there's a whole, discussion, a whole separate discussion to be had about whether if you're doing it commercially, you should volunteer. It's an argument I revisit on many occasions. I find it difficult to be balanced in that situation because obviously I make a career doing it. I specialise in bats. I do really nothing else these days. But also it's my passion and my hobby and my belief as well. So I never had a problem with it. And I meet a lot of people that don't have a problem putting in those extra hours. Is there a case that you should be able to do it like an engineer might go to learn to assess the stress loading on a bridge, on a course, and come away with a certificate at the end of it? I don't know. I find that difficult. Doesn't make it fair or right, but I make that a difficult jump to get to that situation, really.
Richard can't see my phone because it's upside down. But the next question I had, I'm going to read this verbatim. It says, something that seemed to be a contentious issue is that to get any other protected species license, you can get the experience mainly inside your place of work. With bats, the onus is very much on you get that experience outside of work with other people. Why are bats so different? And is it helpful making it that much harder for people to get experience?
I think there's a risk here that we make comparisons. So it's possible to go on a series of courses and get a relatively small amount of experience and be a perfectly competent great crested newt surveyor and a dormouse surveyor, for example. And that's not to belittle those or suggest that they're in any way easy, but they're more straightforward species in many respects because they don't fly, and they're a single species. There isn't 20 of them to deal with. We're looking at least 20, maybe 21 resident species, is it? I can't keep up with the numbers anymore in the UK. 18 breeding species anyway that you've got to have familiarity with because you might encounter them. So at the very least, you need to have read about them and have an understanding of what they look like, of what their ecology could be. And so we should perhaps the way we should frame it is that if you can get your Dormouse license in perhaps 18 months, maybe we need to multiply that amount of hours by 18. You know, that perhaps that's a better way of framing it. And I don't think that exactly works, but perhaps that sort of sets the expectation and the level of complexity different. Because if you compare a greater horseshoe bat to a whiskered bat, or a grey long-eared bat to a noctual bat, you know, the differences are almost as big as the differences in behaviour between a great crested newt and a dormouse, which is a ludicrous thing to say. But, I mean, they really are very, very different creatures whilst being all part of the same group.
We've touched on whether the licensing structure is in need of an update with things like earned recognition coming out. So I'm going to leave that, and I'm going to come on to the next question I had, which was hand netting. The thing that people get stuck up on is hand netting, and it seems it's a skill that's done less these days for various reasons, and it causes so many issues with people trying to get that training for their level 2 license. Is hand netting still relevant, and how do people find the people who are doing that side of things? How do you get around it?
It's a real challenge, and I do struggle as well, because also the thing is that there are only so many accessible roosts. You would only ever want to trap them, certainly for a training exercise, once in a year, because you don't want the bats to become overly disturbed. COVID and the extra restrictions of that, of course, have an implication on that, because we're trying to minimise too much contact. So is it necessary to catch a colony that you've caught the previous 3 years, sort of thing? And probably we better we don't get into the challenges of minimising bat contact and bat training, because I think bat training has its place, but also we do have to be mindful of the requirements as well. I think I'm a big fan of hand netting. I think it really has its place. A good example is to say, how do you know 100 bats coming out of a roof is a breeding colony? Now, you can assume from the numbers, but do you actually know that? I remember catching up a large percentage of a big pipistrelle colony a few years ago, and something over 70% of them were males, which is not what we were expecting. And then suddenly you have to start questioning, well, is this actually a maternity colony? You know. And okay, so there are other tips, like you might see or find babies. Obviously, that's a bit of a clincher. Perhaps even looking at social calls these days, that'll give you some tips as well. But do we actually always know? And simply by catching one or two, we'll often answer that question very, very easily. But it is a skill that's not used so much. So it is hard, and it's a case of finding these roosts that are big enough to allow a proportion to be caught, and doing it on that sort of basis. Because also it's a great way of learning handling, especially if you do it with pipistrelles, feisty, warm, freshly warmed up, newly emerged bats from a nice warm house roost or something like that, and getting them out from the bottom of the net and getting them into the bag, and then getting the net back up quickly, and really thinking about the process and being efficient whilst at the same time treating the bats with the appropriate level of care is quite a useful skill. But it is hard. I struggle. I am struggling to find enough roosts to teach those very skills on. Something also that you can do is, when you get one, is make sure you've got two nets, so you can get one net up, catch, get the next, immediately somebody gets the net straight back up in its place.
That's a good tip. And I guess it goes back to that point you were making earlier, if it's about making those connections, isn't it, to find those people?
Yeah.
And over the years, and as an estimate, how many people do you reckon you've trained?
I think it's through bat license training course and the associated courses, we're looking at about 350, 380, something in that order. Because some people have already got a license when they come to us. That's been a surprise. Some people weren't satisfied with the training that they had, or they felt that in hindsight, at some point, they've come to realise that they were never really properly trained. They came by signatures for their license too easily. That was a revelation for me, and 10 out of 10 to those people for having the presence of mind to address that. And some people are just upgrading from one class of license to another, or perhaps adding handling, or, you know, in some cases even trying to add on the, you know, the more advanced techniques as well, or just gaining experience towards them. That's been another surprise over the years, is how many people come on a course really not expecting anything from it, and just really coming for some more experience on their journey towards perhaps harp trapping or mist netting or something like that.
So how do the four different SNCOs compare then? I know you said that some of the other ones are slightly more, what's the phrase here, pragmatic maybe? How do the four compare?
So most of my experience is within England and Wales. And as it stands at the moment, it's relatively straightforward to get a licence in England. If you send your logbook, fill in the form, if you meet the grade and you've got the two signatures, You'll get it, and you'll usually get it inside of a few days. The difference in Wales is that they will really scrutinise the application. They'll really look at the logbook, and they'll make an informed decision on whether they think you've got enough experience. And actually, that's my preference. I prefer, and I'm not just saying that because I'm based in Wales. I actually mostly train people in England, not in Wales. But my preference is that there should be a level of scrutiny. It's not good enough just to rely on two referees, in my opinion. The logbook is important, and it needs to be good, and it needs to be thorough. And I think I know what I like to see in a logbook now, and it's a good rounded set of experience. It's a good range of species. It's dealing with all the different types of roosts, you know, and it's not something that you can do, you know, in a short period of time. It needs thought. It's important.
So just moving away slightly from the licensing side of thing, in the past you've been a BCT trustee, and you've been very supportive of the organisation since then. What is it about BCT that you like?
To me, the great thing about BCT is that it makes bats approachable to a very wide audience. And I'm not very good at this, and I think a lot of other bat specialists and bat enthusiasts are perhaps not as good as this as we ought to be. We're I suppose geeks to some extent. We like our gadgets, we like to see our bats, you know, and a lot of what we particularly get a kick out of doing is often not that approachable or accessible to the general public. And so there's nothing better than at anybody welcome bat walk and showing them their first bat and enabling them to hear their first bat on a bat detector. And that's about the best thing in the world, actually. And if we can start from that point of view, and I think something that BCT have been very good at championing is also engaging minority communities, people from different ethnicities. The passing train, and even people with disabilities and things like that, just making it more approachable to a wide audience, you know. And I think that's brilliant. And then supporting people through, you know, through their journeys, through training courses and conferences and that kind of thing, you know, supporting and enabling and what's the word I'm looking for?
Facilitating
research and things like that. Yeah, finding gaps, thankless tasks like the bat survey guidelines, you know. I was in a meeting on the fourth edition of the bat survey guidelines. Here we are again. How many years is it now? It's 2006, was it the first edition, yeah, or something? And I literally said at one point, of course, if we could just train people properly and have confidence in their training, we actually wouldn't need any survey guidelines. And I thought, oh, there's a good point. And I think everybody who's providing training or supporting people through their learning journey, particularly towards a license, should really have that in mind, because that sort of answers all the problems. You know, if everybody's got a really good understanding of the why, it's all about the why. You know, where are we going? What do we need to achieve with this information? Rather than just turning up and seeing if there's any bats there. It's before that point. It's understanding what's that going to mean, and working out about, you know, the significance of levels of activity and stuff like that. So it's far from straightforward, but it would make for a lot better survey reports as well, I think.
Richard, that's been really insightful. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
No problems. Thank you very much.
Massive thanks to Richard for giving us that insight despite the drizzle and for giving me my annual fix of lesser horseshoe bats. We've put a link in the show notes to Richard's training website as well as his social media pages. And that brings us to the end of Series 5 of Bat Chats. I really hope you've enjoyed listening to all of our guests this series and the bat conservation stories being told. As a show, it really helps us reach more people if you leave us a review about Bat Chat, either in your podcast app or on social media. Instructions of how to leave a review are in the show notes, and you can tag us on social media using the hashtag BatsChat. Recording for Series 6 of Bat Chat is already underway and will be coming later in the year. We're looking for local bat and conservation stories to feature on the podcast, so if you're working on a great bat project or have a story about the bats in your area to share, please drop us an email to the address in the show notes, and you never know, Bat Chat might be making a visit to you in the near future. With the first signs of spring on the way, we hope you all have a fantastic summer getting out there and enjoy seeing bats in the night sky. Bat Chat is an original podcast from the Bat Conservation Trust. The series producer and editor was me, Steve Rowe, and I need to give a huge thanks to all of my guests this series, because without them, this show wouldn't happen. And thanks as well to the communications team at BCT, Joe Nunes-Mino and Andrea Correa da Costa, for their fabulous support in promoting us on social media and linking to the episodes on the BCT website. And of course, without you listening to us, there wouldn't be any point in producing the show. So a huge thanks to you guys, our listeners, for your ongoing support of the show. Now, lots of you have seen me in branded t-shirts and hoodies with the Bat Chat logo on, and you've all been asking me when they'll be available. Well, we're thrilled to let you know that a whole range of Bat Chat clothing and tote bags is now available for you on our T-Mill store, the link's in the show notes. Whether you're a long-time supporter or a new member of the Bat Chat family, we can't wait for you to share your photos of you wearing our merch on social media. Be sure to tag the Bat Conservation Trust in your posts. If you're listening to Bat Chat on Google Podcasts, we wanted to let you know that Google have announced they plan to discontinue their app later this year, so we recommend making the switch to an alternative podcast app, and we've put some links in the show notes to alternative apps that you can follow Bat Chat on so that you don't miss any future episodes.